And thanks also for the invitation to speak here. So I'm going to be talking about cosmic neutrinos and other light relics. So for those of you who were here 6 months ago, I talked about something similar, and I promised not to overlap so much with that talk. So this is a talk that's based on a recent paper I had with Daniel Bauman, Dan Green, and Benjamin Wallish. So a lot of the details that I will omit can be found in this paper. So this work grew out of considering the possibility of what do we do with all this influx of data from the CMB that we have coming up. So to be a little bit specific, here is a rough history of the sensitivity of CMB experiments we've had for the last decade or so. And so you can see plotted on the y-axis is the approximate raw sensitivity of various experiments with time on the x-axis. And you see that this follows a Moore's law for CMB sensitivity. And this basically just comes from the fact that what's increasing with time is the number of detectors that are available on a given CMB experiment. And that increases basically with our ability to print silicon smaller and smaller. And so I'll just highlight some of the things on here. So WMAP and Planck, presumably everybody is familiar with. Those are satellite missions that have done a huge amount to advance the field of CMB science. In the various other colors are the ground-based experiments with a nomenclature that I'll be using throughout the talk. So CMB stage one refers to ACT and SPT. And those experiments had roughly 100 detectors or so. In blue, you see CMB stage two. Those are ACT pole and SPT pole. So those missions have basically finished their data collection. In dotted blue here, you see CMB stage three, and this refers to advanced ACT and SPT 3G. So those things are under construction, starting to take data, et cetera. And then down here, you have CMB stage four. Now, CMB stage four is still in the proposal stage. It was a pretty exciting time a few years ago for CMB science when the US Department of Energy agreed to, or I should say, put support behind CMB with this CMB stage four. So the idea here is this is a combined effort from the teams of both ACT and SPT, as well as some smaller experiments. So it's sort of a unified front for CMB science in the United States. It was a really big event when the Department of Energy provided their support for CMB science, because traditionally they're in the business of funding things like accelerators and particle physics experiments. So the fact that they're willing to fund a CMB experiment shows that they recognize that there is value for particle physicists, for high energy theory that comes from CMB. So the project that I'm going to discuss and a lot of the work that I'm going to discuss grew out of thinking about what is the science that we can do with CMB S4. So that's kind of the rough motivation I'll have in mind throughout this talk. So this slide is probably my most controversial. I think we can all agree to find something to disagree with on this slide. So this is a very biased, very abridged history of CMB science. So going back to the 1940s, the CMB was sort of theoretically predicted when Ralph Elfer and Hermann predicted the existence of the CMB basically by working out Big Bang cosmology as we more or less know it today. So essentially all the properties of the CMB were predicted way back in at the end of the 40s or so. So CMB has been a theoretical science for about 70 years, roughly. It became an observational science with the discovery of Penzias and Wilson in 1964. So it's been an observational science for about 50 years. Since then, there's been a very rapid improvement in the observational side of things. That sort of started in earnest with COBE. And what I'm highlighting here in these last several bullet points are sort of my, again, very biased and very limited view on what are the main scientific takeaways from each of these experiments. So from COBE, we obviously learned a huge amount, but I think the scientific takeaway was that it really established Big Bang cosmology as being more or less the correct view of the history of our universe. It was also the first to detect the anisotropies in the temperature of the microwave background. So WMAP then went on to measure the first three acoustic peaks of the power spectrum, the CMB power spectrum. So there's a lot of science that came out of that, but I think if you wanted to summarize it in just a phrase, I would say WMAP basically solidified and measured all the parameters of lambda CDM cosmology. It obviously was a huge legacy data set for all sorts of astrophysics and all sorts of other things, but from, again, my biased perspective, I would say the big advancement that came from WMAP was to establish lambda CDM cosmology. Planck then went on to measure temperature and polarization more accurately, and this is probably the most controversial thing I'll say. For me, the biggest takeaway from Planck was a vastly improved measurement of non-Gaussianity. I think most people in the Planck team would maybe disagree and try to hang their hat on something else, but I think for me, for a theorist, the biggest step forward that came out of Planck was the measurement, the improved constraints on non-Gaussianity. I think that was the biggest kind of characteristic shift in the things they did. Of course, they tightened error bars. They did a lot of great things for both astrophysics, galactic astronomy, all of these kinds of things. But again, from my perspective, non-Gaussianity was the biggest step forward. So looking ahead then to CMB stage 3 and CMB stage 4, the natural question to ask is what is the biggest science takeaway that we can expect out of these experiments? So these three categories were sort of highlighted by the DOE when they threw support behind CMB stage 4. And I also think they were pretty accurate. I think these are the things that we can kind of most hope for to come out of CMB stage 4. So the first being gravitational waves. So this is the measurement of the tensor to scalar ratio. So obviously this has been hotly debated and discussed over the past several years. I think everybody can agree that it would be super exciting if we made a detection of gravitational waves. On the other hand, there is no reasonable expectation that we will make a detection. So this is absolutely a goal worth going after. It's absolutely something we should be doing. On the other hand, we will be fortunate if we make a detection. So upper bounds are still useful here, but in principle, we can keep pushing down the upper bound forever and never make a detection. Neutrino mass, on the other hand, is something of a guaranteed detection in CMB stage 4, modulo some issues that I won't get into, but it's more or less a guaranteed signal that will come out of CMB stage 3 and 4. This was really exciting for the DOE because there's a big neutrino program in the US and in US particle physics. And so the fact that this is a measurement that can be made with cosmology, which is very complementary to the types of measurements that can be made in laboratory experiments, oscillation experiments, et cetera, this was a very exciting target. And it's something that is essentially guaranteed science that will come out of CMB stage 3 and CMB stage 4. And effective, which will be basically the focus of this talk, is something that is also guaranteed to improve, but naively you might think that it doesn't have the same sort of weight as the other two. What I'd like to argue is just the opposite, that in fact, an effective is perhaps the most exciting science that will come out of CMB stage 3 and CMB stage 4. Apart from the possibility of measuring gravitational waves. I think if we make a detection of gravitational waves, that will be a huge breakthrough. It'll have very vast sweeping consequences. But again, it's not a guarantee. With ineffective, on the other hand, I think we really will be able to push the field forward and really get some very good takeaways. Neutrino mass, despite being a guaranteed detection, I think from the particle physics point of view, it's not a particularly interesting number, and people can feel free to disagree with me on that as well. I just don't think it's inherently interesting to know the mass scale, and yeah, people may disagree. While it is great to kind of set a data point and be complementary to laboratory experiments, I don't know that anybody is particularly interested in knowing the specific value of the neutrino masses. But again, feel free to jump in and disagree.
I think Wayne is interested. Yeah, I mean, this is supposed to be the most controversial slide. I think nobody has objected yet. So.
All right, so I guess it'll be should be agreement the rest of the way then, I guess. Okay, so like I said, I'm going to try to convince you throughout the rest of the talk that ineffective is something that we should care about and should get excited about, and we sort of have guaranteed payoff from CMB stage 4. So what is ineffective? Ineffective is known as the effective number of neutrino species, which is where its name comes from. On the other hand, what it measures is the total radiation energy density during the times of interest. So this is, roughly speaking, at temperatures between an MeV down to an EV or so, or slightly less than that, or times or redshifts between 1100 or so and like 10 to the 10, roughly. And what it measures is the total radiation energy density. So it, because it gets contributions from all sorts of radiation energy density apart from photons, it need not have anything to do with neutrinos. So in principle, it casts a very wide net. It measures all sorts of decoupled radiation. Anything that's around that makes a significant enough contribution to the energy density is encapsulated in this quantity and effective. So if we can measure it, that's great, because we've learned something about the general energy content of the universe. And in fact, it is measurable through the gravitational effects of this radiation. So despite the fact that radiation makes up a very insignificant fraction of the total energy density in the universe today, during the times of interest, it made a very significant contribution to the energy density. So specifically in the standard model, of cosmology and particle physics, we do know of one contribution to ineffective, and that comes from the cosmic neutrino background. So the theoretical expectation from the standard model is that ineffective is made up only of cosmic neutrinos. And so we'd like to work out then how large we expect ineffective to be in the standard model. So the cosmic neutrino background you can think about as being in a very good analogy with the cosmic microwave background. So with the cosmic microwave background, the usual story is there was a time early enough in the universe such that atoms couldn't form. And so photons interacted frequently with all the charged particles that exist in the plasma. As the universe cooled and expanded, hydrogen became bound. That's recombination. Photons were then free to propagate throughout the universe. And that's what those photons are what we observe and call the CMB. The same basic story holds true for cosmic neutrinos. There was an even higher temperature where the weak interaction was efficient enough to keep neutrinos in thermal equilibrium with the rest of the plasma. So they scattered frequently in the very early universe. And then again, as the universe expanded and cooled, the temperature dropped below some point where neutrinos were essentially free to travel ever since. So those neutrinos make up the cosmic neutrino background. And just like in the case of the cosmic microwave background, the prediction then for the cosmic neutrinos is that they should have a thermal spectrum. But because neutrinos are fermions as opposed to bosons, they carry a thermal Fermi-Dirac distribution as opposed to Bose-Einstein distribution. So the only parameter we need to know, up to some small corrections, in order to know all the properties of the cosmic neutrino background is the temperature. Okay. That temperature we can compute just by a simple counting. So specifically, neutrinos decoupled from the plasma when the plasma contained electrons, positrons, and photons, and then some small contamination of baryons also. Baryons don't make a significant enough contribution to the energy density to bother us here, but neutrinos decoupled basically just before electron-positron annihilation. So in the limit of instantaneous decoupling, that is when the neutrino interactions are just shut off at an instant that occurs before electron-positron annihilation, you can compute the change in temperature of the photons due to the annihilation of electrons and positrons just by using the fact that co-moving entropy is conserved within the plasma. So this effect, the annihilation of electrons and positrons, heats the photons relative to neutrinos and ends up giving a factor of 4/11 to the 1/3, which is where that factor comes from here. And the 7/8 comes from the fact, that neutrinos are fermions. So in the limit of instantaneous decoupling, you would predict that ineffective is just equal to the number of species of neutrinos you have, hence the nomenclature there. So in the limit of instantaneous decoupling in the standard model of particle physics, ineffective would be 3, exactly 3. On the other hand, we know that neutrinos don't instantaneously decouple, so there are some small corrections to this. So specifically, there's some residual heating of neutrinos due to the fact that they haven't completely decoupled at the time that electrons and positrons annihilated. And so this residual heating leads to a small increase over the value of 3 that you'd predict in the limit of instantaneous decoupling. there's also some complicated finite temperature effects that change this slightly, but basically the prediction amounts to the fact that N effective in the standard model is equal to 3.046. So it turns out that this number has a little bit of theoretical uncertainty. This number has been computed basically by just one group listed here. And the uncertainty is probably small, but nobody has really checked how small it is. I think the groups agree that the 3.04 is probably correct. There's probably some error in the last digit there. It's not quite at the level where we should be too worried about it, but it's something that we should probably work out before we really have data from CMBS4. So this computation is a numerical computation that relies on calculating this. So there's a number of things that go into that 0.046. So when you include like the finite masses of electrons and positrons at the time that they annihilate, that slightly changes things. When you do this computation, you can do it cleanly if you assume that these annihilations take place in vacuum. But of course, in the early universe, there's a plasma. These lead to like thermal masses to the various contributions to your diagrams and things like that. And basically, the only uncertainty comes from doing the calculation all together, all at once. If you do them separately, you can isolate them, and you see that they sum basically to this. But only one group has done the fully consistent calculation where everything goes together. So again, if you do the computations separately, that is the various contributions that you expect to correct the value of 3.0, you get something like 3.03 from one of the chunks of the calculation, and then an additional 0.01 from another chunk of the calculation. So I think everyone agrees that this is about the right number. Everybody agrees on the sign of the corrections and all of that kind of stuff, but there's some small uncertainty that remains to be confirmed. I think this group would say that they got it right. Other groups just need to check. Basically.
There's some violation at some level of adiabaticity, which is sort of, is that negligible contribution? I mean,
adiabaticity in what sense?
Just in the sense that ultimately that comes from demanding conservation of entropy from before and after the annihilation.
Mm-hmm. Right, good. Right. So that's true to a high degree on large enough scales. So I guess probably the effect you're talking about would be true on very, very small scales, but I think those all get averaged out for the quantity of relevance here. Is that, or am I misunderstanding your question? I can imagine there would be fluctuations on very small scales where you have, say, more neutrinos in some places than others on very, very small scales. But for all large scales, everything that would have been outside the horizon at that time, you'd expect adiabaticity to hold very accurately.
This is important part of physics, because it rules out four generations. That's always important.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a big thing.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So, historically, this number was always important because it was our first hint that there was not a fourth generation. So typically what's quoted today is the width of the Z boson, the width of the Z resonance, as determining the number of generations of neutrinos or more generally leptons. But that only holds true for active neutrinos. And in any case, this measurement came before. So this was very important for establishing the fact that there are three species.
My recollection is people were talking about that one. This was instead five. This was five and like 5 years ago.
Oh, from CMB.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. So yeah, there are two measurements that we can make of this, which is my next slide. So there's two ways that we can observe this. Historically, the best observation came from primordial abundances, and so. Yeah, basically, BBN, the theory of Big Bang nucleosynthesis makes a prediction, a theoretical prediction, for the primordial abundances of light elements. This is affected by the total radiation energy density, which I'll come back to in just a second. But using these measurements, you can constrain N effective today to be 3.28 plus or minus 0.28. Likewise, you can measure things from the CMB, and I'll go into the complicated effects that go into that in a little bit. But the measurements here basically agree with one another and agree with the prediction of the standard model, including only three species of neutrinos. Right, so historically, the best measurement came from primordial abundances, so let me just go through where this comes from. So as I said, the theory of Big Bang nucleosynthesis makes predictions for the abundances of light elements produced in the early universe. So the idea here, and the reason you're sensitive to an effective through this measurement, is that the way that Big Bang nucleosynthesis proceeds is you start with some distribution of protons and neutrons, which is actually in part fixed by the presence of neutrinos, something I'll come back to in just a second. And at some point when neutrinos decouple, the interconversion of protons and neutrons becomes inefficient. So the only way that they can interconvert is by the free decay of neutrons. So there's some temperature at which neutrinos decouple, and neutrons will just continue to decay up until the time when the temperature has dropped below a certain value, which allows deuterium to form. Once deuterium forms, it builds up into helium-4, helium-3, lithium-7, beryllium-7, which decays to lithium-7, and a very small amount of lithium-6. So this process basically depends on the initial value of the proton to neutron ratio and the time which is available for neutrons to decay before they become bound into deuterium. So the way that this becomes sensitive to N-effective is that N-effective contributes to the total radiation energy density, which contributes to the total expansion rate during this time, which affects the relationship between time and temperature in this early phase of the universe. So as I increase N-effective, I increase the expansion rate, thereby reducing the amount of time between neutron freeze out and formation of deuterium. So I've reduced the amount of time that neutrons have to decay, and therefore I increase the amount of deuterium that gets formed. So again, as I increase N-effective, I increase the amount of deuterium, and hence increase the amount of helium-4 that's formed in the early universe. So helium-4 traditionally was the best way that we had to measure N-effective. And so it's from primordial helium-4 measurements that we get a constraint on N-effective. Now, this story has changed a little bit recently because our deuterium measurements have become so good as to be competitive with the measurements of N-effective that come from YP, from helium-4 abundance. So that's contained in this paper, Cook et al., using quasar absorption systems to measure deuterium abundance. So it's actually gotten to a point where the theoretical uncertainty on the deuterium abundance is larger than the measurement uncertainty. So we actually have to improve our measurements of nuclear cross-sections before we can make full use of this data. Good, so the takeaway here is basically that BBN, the theory of BBN, and the measurement of primordial abundances gives us a constraint on N-effective, and specifically this gives us a constraint on N-effective at the time of BBN. So this is about 3 minutes after the end of inflation or whatever other early universe model you like, 3 minutes after the Big Bang, so to speak. So the other measurement that we have on N-effective comes from a study of the CMB power spectrum. So the most prominent effect of N-effective on the CMB power spectrum comes from the damping tail. That statement has a few caveats. So you might think the most prominent effect is to change, say, matter radiation equality, which is true, but those things are measured very accurately. So when people say that increasing the number of neutrinos increases the amount of damping in the CMB, what they mean is when we hold all the stuff that we measure very well fixed, changing N-effective changes the damping tail. So specifically, when we hold fixed the baryon fraction, the matter radiation equality scale, and the angular size of the first peak, roughly, then increasing the number of neutrinos, or sorry, increasing N-effective increases the amount of damping that occurs at small angular scales. So that's the most prominent effect. There are additional effects which come from the fact that neutrinos free stream. And those can be separated into two different contributions. So when you fix the damping scale, you can still see that N-effective contributes to a small shift in the amplitude. which comes from neutrino free streaming. And then also there's a small shift in the phase of the acoustic peaks. So this phase shift is going to become very important in the story later on, and I'll come back and explain in more detail where that comes from. But the upshot is that right now with Planck data, we get a constraint on n-effective from the CMB times, so again this is at later times, that is equal to 3.04 plus or minus a small amount. So again, these measurements agree with one another and agree with the predictions of the standard model. So that's great. And as I mentioned earlier, these constraints will improve and improve rather significantly over the next 10 or so years. So from Advanced ACT and SPT3G, the so-called CMB stage 3 experiments, we'll get about a factor of 3 improvement over the current constraints from Planck. And then from CMB stage 4, we'll get roughly another factor of 3 or so improvement. I've also included here the improvements on neutrino mass. This really won't be relevant for us, but their numbers are there in case you are concerned about those. So the biggest leap forward comes from polarization in these measurements. So I'll come back and talk about why that is later on. But the big advance that comes from the ground-based experiments will be measuring small angle polarization. All right. So that's basically the observational situation as it stands and as it will be for the next 10 or so years. So why do we care about this from the theoretical side? Well, as I mentioned earlier, n-effective is not just a measurement of the number of neutrino species. It casts a very wide net and measures all sorts of other forms of dark radiation. So all kinds of dark radiation, varying from gravitational waves to sterile neutrinos to dark photons. Whatever light species you might have around in the early universe contributes to n-effective, and therefore any constraint, any observational constraint on n-effective gives an observational constraint on all these things that might contribute to the radiation density in the early universe. So for example, what's plotted here is several years ago there was some excitement over these short baseline neutrino oscillation experiments, which seemed to hint at the existence of a sterile neutrino. The most naive interpretation of that, in terms of a single sterile neutrino, it turns out, were already ruled out by cosmology, specifically because of this measurement of n-effective. So this is the way that n-effective might help to constrain particle physics ideas. I think this has mostly gone away by now, but this just gives you one example of how n-effective can constrain and inform our particle physics knowledge. You can also get gravitational wave constraints. This is something Latham has worked on, for example. We did a reanalysis with current data, or almost current data. I guess it's slightly out of date as of a couple weeks ago. So basically the idea here is gravitational waves are relativistic species as far as the CMB and BBN are concerned. It doesn't matter that they're gravitational waves. All that matters is that they contribute radiation energy density to the early universe. If you have a large amount of gravitational waves floating around, they will show up in a contribution to n-effective. So this does not provide a strong constraint on the overall amplitude of gravitational waves, but if you have a spectrum that's very blue tilted, so that you have more gravitational waves on small scales with higher wave number, higher momentum, you end up getting a very significant contribution to the energy density. And therefore, you can place constraints on the tensor tilt. So we went through an analysis here, just assuming a power law for the primordial gravitational wave spectrum. And what you can see is that you get some constraints, some upper bound on NT that comes just from, basically comes from the measurement of n-effective. These are just various combinations of data sets. And what you see is that if R is large enough to measure in the near future, you get a pretty firm upper bound that comes from an integrated constraint, which arises from n-effective. So that basically cuts off, you can imagine these curves should be cut off at 0.07, roughly. It will push everything to the left on these plots. I should also say on these plots, we The way we sampled very poorly the very low values of R. So in principle, there's no constraint on NT at the very low values of R. If you drop R low enough, it doesn't matter what the tilt is. It's just not contributing anything to the energy density. And that's just based on how we sampled. But in principle, these things should extend up to infinity at the very, very low values of R.
This is what I was just about to ask. I mean, there's no, when you say NT is, has an upfront of 0.5, what prevents NT from being 1, but R is being greater than
2? Yeah, no, that's a completely fair point. I should have put that caveat in the text here. I should have said basically for the regimes that are measurable in the near future for R, it's actually not very sensitive to R. So even if R was, say, 10 to the minus 3, the constraint on NT doesn't change that much. And that just comes from how the integral of the total energy density works. So it drops some, but it doesn't drop very much. It predicts specifically that it's negative. Inflation, all models of inflation, regardless of multi-field, single-field, whatever, all models of inflation predict that NT is negative. It's in some sense a definition of inflation because inflation is basically the statement that the expansion rate is nearly constant but decreasing over some period of time in the early universe. NT is just a measurement of exactly that. It's a measurement of the change of the expansion rate. And so if NT is positive, that means the expansion rate is increasing. And so this is really only putting constraints on models. Should be a little bit careful here. I was about to say it's only putting constraints on models that violate the null energy condition, though in principle, this spectrum can come from anywhere. So you could have late time contributions to this. The bottom line is that you can get a constraint on NT, but a constraint that's not particularly interesting for inflation, only for alternatives. Okay. Perhaps the most interesting takeaway from a constraint on NT comes from thinking about thermal relics. So in the case of sterile neutrinos, in the case of gravitational waves, there's no real expected contribution that you would get. It's essentially a free parameter. You do get some upper bound, but you can sort of argue about how interesting it might be. However, with thermal relics, you can make very definite predictions about the expected contribution to N effective for the same reason that I explained in the case of neutrinos. So neutrinos are just an example of a thermal relic that happens to decouple at about 1 MeV. What's being plotted here would be the expected contributions to N effective from various sorts of thermal relics that decoupled at various temperatures. So on the x-axis, you see the decoupling temperature. And on the y-axis, on the right side, is plotted the contribution to N effective from scalars, Weyl fermions, Dirac fermions, or gauge fields. And what you can see is let me actually first of all point out in the plot here, there's a very sharp uptick at the QCD phase transition. And this comes from the fact that the number of degrees of freedom changes very rapidly during the QCD phase transition. For things that decouple after the QCD phase transition, they just don't get diluted very much. And so if they were in thermal contact after the QCD phase transition, they make a fairly significant contribution to N effective. And those things are what are disfavored by Planck. On the other hand, before the QCD phase transition, the energy density, or the temperature, if you like, becomes very suppressed compared to the rest of the plasma, because if they decoupled back here, then you pass through the QCD phase transition, all the degrees of freedom that were previously in equilibrium annihilate, decay, et cetera, into the degrees of freedom of the standard model. And so that dilutes the contribution from these other thermal relics. What's interesting here is that the level at which they contribute is right around the error bar, the proposed error bar of CMB stage 4. And this extends, so this plot's cut off here at a few hundred GeV, but this plot extends essentially to arbitrarily high temperature. You would need something very, very drastic to happen to cause a much bigger dilution than what's shown here. So you could imagine getting around this by saying you have an extremely complicated dark sector, for example, with many, many degrees of freedom, all of which then decay into standard model stuff. But apart from that, these curves basically extend very far in energy.
And every time you hit a part of a mass, it drops a little bit, like it gets up far.
Yeah, so the top quark and the Higgs and all those kinds of things are contained here.
No, the 100 G, 120 G, I don't, I guess it's supposed to be there, I don't see any.
Drop. Yeah, so this is, so it's a log scale, so this is 200 GeV.
Uh-huh. You already have top quark and Higgs stuff to be there.
Yeah, that's right, okay. That's right. And even so, so all the standard model stuff is contained in here. Let's say we miss the top quark on the right. That's only a change in G star of 1, and G star is like 200 up here. So it's a very, very small fractional change. G star counts the number of degrees of freedom, which is what's relevant for constraint having co-moving entropy density conserved. So it's only large changes in G star that affect significantly the thermal abundance. Yeah?
So this, by light, meaning this is a constraint on particles that were relative.
Relativistic at decoupling, that's right. Yep. Yeah, so if they're more massive, in particular, this doesn't rule out a thermal relic dark matter, for example, because we know it was non-relativistic and it doesn't contribute to ineffective. But it would rule out the possibility that dark matter has, that the dark sector has, say, light gauge fields. Now, if those gauge fields couple to the dark matter, the phenomenology gets a little bit more complicated, because then you expect things like dark acoustic oscillations and dark matter then doesn't clump and all sorts of stuff. So there are specific scenarios where this picture doesn't hold, but by and large, if we put an upper limit on delta N effective that was 0.02 or so, you could rule out all thermal relics up to a very, very high temperature in one fell swoop. Okay, so I think this is fairly exciting. What this is saying is, even if we don't detect a deviation from the standard model prediction from CMBS4 of N-effective, we've ruled out a huge class of models. And we've learned a great deal about particle physics. Supersymmetry, in principle, does affect this. There's a huge number of degrees of freedom in most supersymmetric models that, in principle, have frozen out above some temperature. And that would change this picture, because that would be a significant perturbation to G star. You could, in principle, include it. The simplest models would be like an order 2 contribution to G star. So you'd imagine shifting all these curves down by a factor of 2. Good. Furthermore, we have a measurement. As I said, we have two measurements of N effective, one that comes from primordial abundances and another that comes from the CMB. These measurements are taken at different times. So specifically, the primordial abundances measure N effective at about 3 minutes or so, whereas N effective from the CMB measures this quantity at about 380,000 years after the end of inflation. By getting good constraints on both of these numbers, we can actually constrain also the time-dependent changes to either N effective or to photon energy density. So this includes things like decays in the dark sector or late photon heating. So for example, if an axion heats up the photons, that actually tends to dilute the N-effective neutrinos, et cetera, relative to photons. And so you could have situations where N-effective measured at BBN times is less than the CMB. That's the case where you have dark sector decays, likewise. And the other way is also possible, where N-effective at BBN is larger than that measured from the CMB if you've heated the photons between those two times. Yeah, so it'll improve some. So this is sort of out of the purview of CMB. The constraint on YP, the primordial helium-4 abundance, will improve from CMB. I'll actually come back to that a little bit later. It won't improve so significantly that there would be, it's not going to be competitive with the constraint from CMB and effective alone, but the constraint will be comparable with what it is today. So that is, the measurement of YP constrains N effective at BBN times, comparable to the CMB constraint today. So the error bar will be like 0.2. That's right.
And then if it's
If it became non-relativistic, is that what you asked? Yeah, then it would presumably contribute to dark matter then. So in that case.
Yeah.
So it depends specifically when. If it becomes non-relativistic, say way before BBN, it looks like dark matter and effective doesn't say anything about it. If it becomes non-relativistic between BBN and the CMB times, what it would look like is a large N effective at BBN, and then your dark matter density has increased between the time of BBN and the time of CMB. And so N effective would be measured to be, say, 3.046 at CMB times and higher than that in BBN. So there you, I mean, if the, yeah, depending on the time that it becomes non-relativistic, it would either be a time-dependent N effective. And if it's too early, it looks like dark matter N effective doesn't have anything to say about it.
But practice will never measure N effective well enough at BBN, I guess, to measure the time dependency. I guess that makes it sound like
Yeah, so it depends how optimistic you are about astrophysical measurements. So I commented on CMB improvements on N effective at BBN. Deuterium measurements have come a very long way within the last 2 years, so much so that you're actually now limited by theoretical uncertainties. So if you improve nuclear rates, et cetera, and get a huge sample of quasar absorption spectra, you can imagine pinning deuterium abundance down even better. And then you get a better measurement on an effective. There's no reason you can't improve the YP measurement also. So in principle, you can do better with BBN. I don't think we know what the fundamental limit is. It's a little bit easier to predict that kind of thing for CMB because you just do a mode counting. With astrophysics, it's complicated because it depends on the number of pristine systems and all sorts of astrophysical uncertainties and complicated fits that are include parameters that are not related to BBN. So I think it's hard to guess what the ultimate limit of astrophysical measurements is. All right, so I'm running a bit short on time here, but I want to mention that the phase shift that comes from an effective, so specifically that comes from the free streaming component of the radiation, plays a special role and will play a special role moving forward. And so this is the case for a number of specific reasons. So first of all, it's very difficult to produce a phase shift at high L, a phase shift of the acoustic peaks at high L in the CMB, without something that free streams, or more specifically, without something that travels faster than the speed of sound in the plasma. The phase shift helps to break degeneracies that would otherwise be present without the phase shift. You can actually distinguish various forms of dark radiation by measuring the phase shift. So I've been talking as though all radiation is created equal in this, in some sense, but that's actually not entirely true. If the radiation self-couples, then it doesn't free stream and doesn't contribute to the phase shift. So there's actually two separate measurements you can make. One is the total energy density, and another is the amount of free streaming energy density. And so you can break that degeneracy and actually probe the nature of the dark radiation. And then furthermore, in the future, constraints will be driven almost entirely by the phase shift. I shouldn't say almost entirely. They're driven significantly by the phase shift. They become robust due to the phase shift, and the improvements that come from polarization come largely from the phase shift. So let me kind of go through some of that. So this plot I already showed. This shows the effect of changing the number of, changing N effective. So the damping tail, I said, is the most prominent, sort of the most visible effect. It turns out, however, that it is controlled not just by N effective, but also by the free electron density at the time of decoupling. And as a result, it's sensitive also to YP, the primordial helium abundance. The reason for this is that helium has a higher binding energy than hydrogen. And so the presence of helium changes, so increasing the amount of helium reduces the amount of free electrons at the time of decoupling. The bottom line basically is that the free streaming scale is affected both by YP and by N effective, and so there's a degeneracy there. That degeneracy is weakly broken by effects that are not related to the phase shift, like the fact that the visibility function of the CMB is also affected by the free electron density. And so you can distinguish based on the amplitude of polarization compared to temperature. But anyway, the phase shift helps significantly in breaking the degeneracy between ineffective and YP. What this means is you can measure both simultaneously from the same experiment by using the phase shift. So the amplitude shift that comes from free streaming, unfortunately, is not particularly useful. It is an effect that's there, but the amplitude is controlled by so many cosmological parameters that it would be really difficult to disentangle what part comes from neutrino free streaming as compared to other stuff. So it's an effect that's there. It's implicit in the constraints, but it's not particularly useful on its own. On the other hand, the phase shift is very closely associated with free streaming. So it's very closely tied to the existence of an effective and to the existence of something that's traveling faster than the speed of
sound.
Presumably there is to some degree that comes from the damping tail. Presumably the running can mimic the damping. The phase shift would help to break that degeneracy.
But also, I'm just thinking like running could also mimic the phase shift, right? Because if you, I mean, the peaks, if you multiply that by I guess, a parallel, then the peak would move.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. That's a good point. We haven't studied in detail how much of a degeneracy that is, but that's a fair point, absolutely. So let me just briefly say where the phase shift comes from. It turns out it's controlled by the analytic properties of the Green's function. And the upshot is essentially that there are very few things that can mimic it. So there are only two physical conditions that lead to this phase shift. That fact comes from the fact that it's the analytic properties of the Green's function that determine this quantity. And so there's only a few things that you can do mathematically that translate directly into a few physical constraints. So one of which is if you have something, you have some sort of fluctuation, some modes that travel faster than the sound speed of the plasma. So the sound speed of the plasma here I'm referring to is the photon baryon plasma. And so the sound speed is 1/3 in natural units. Whereas neutrinos free stream at the speed of light. And so they couple then to the photons through the gravitational potential. And that then contributes to a contribution to the evolution equations of photon perturbations, which has a source that travels faster than the speed of light. And that that sort of supersonic motion is what leads to a phase shift. The other contribution to the phase shift comes from non-adiabatic fluctuations. So if you have initial conditions that are non-adiabatic, you can have a differing phase. So I won't go into that too much, but that's basically the only other thing that can contribute to the phase shift. So the phase shift is measurable in data. So what I'm plotting here is the 7th peak of temperature and the 7th peak of polarization. The dotted lines are the lensed spectra, so that's what we really observe on the sky. And the solid lines are the unlensed spectra. So if you can delens very accurately, for example, this is what you would see. So lensing smooths out peaks, delensing resharpens them. And then the red and blue lines. So the blue line is basically the standard picture where N effective is equal to 3.046. The red line is where I've taken away some of the free streaming contribution and moved it over into a form of radiation that doesn't free stream. So I've kept the total radiation energy density fixed, but I've changed some from free streaming to non-free streaming. And what you can see is that there's a shift in the peaks. So that's just demonstrating that this phase shift, the phase shift looks like a constant at high L, and you can just see it here. It turns out that the phase shift is most visible in the unlensed EE spectrum. This is due to the fact that the peaks are sharper in polarization to begin with, and then delensing further sharpens peaks. So if you really want to measure the phase shift, what you'd want to do is have the EE spectrum and delens it. So this phase shift has been observed in data. So in Planck 2013, these folks isolated the phase shift and showed that you can actually get a significant constraint on the phase shift with Planck temperature alone. So in the standard model, so what they have is in the top panel on the y-axis, they have N effective of the phase shift, which is what I've been calling just N effective. And on the bottom, they have the total radiation energy density. So in the standard model, those things are equal and equal to 3.046. And you can see that the constraints agree with that. So this has been detected. The effect of the free streaming has been detected in the CMB. On the right, what I'm plotting are the constraints on N effective and N fluid. So N effective refers to free streaming radiation energy density. an N fluid is non-free streaming radiation. So in principle, those are two kinds of dark radiation that contribute to the total energy density. And the N fluid is self-interacting or something, so it doesn't contribute to the anisotropic stress. So you can constrain both of these quantities simultaneously in the CMB. And the fact that you get a constraint on N effective, even when N fluid is allowed to vary, shows you that the anisotropic stress is important for making these constraints. So these are the Planck 2015 constraints. The two different curves come from when YP is allowed to vary in red and when it's not, when it's fixed for BBN consistency in green. So you can see also that the degeneracy with YP is largely broken by the phase shift also. And then the small curves there are the forecasts for a CMB S4 experiment. And so you can see these things will really tighten up in the future. And CMB S4 will be able to provide useful constraints simultaneously on N effective, N fluid, and YP.
So
it's slightly unclear right now. What I can say is that the goal is to get to 1 μK arc minute noise, which would make polarization, and then square root of 2 for polarization on top of that. So that would be cosmic variance limited out to L of 2000 and some, not all the way to 4000, say, but 2000 and some roughly. That's still in flux, but we're still in the planning stages, but yeah, that's the idea. All right, so I will wrap up there. I'm a little over time, so I will just leave my conclusions here, and thanks for your attention.
Good questions for John?
I just wanted to speak up belatedly in defense of measuring the total neutrino mass. There is one interesting thing in my mind about that, which is that so we know there's right-handed neutrinos, we think there's right-handed neutrinos that explain the mass measurements, so the simple possibility that there's three left-handed guys and three right-handed guys.
Mm-hmm. Good, yeah. No, that's great. Yeah, that's the kind of thing we should care about. Yeah, absolutely. Do you know what, if it was, say, 0.01 EV, if the lightest one was 0.01 EV, is that too massive?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, many orders of magnitude down. Okay, thanks, yeah, that's good.
So I guess I had a comment about, so you said that how much this N effective BBN versus N effective CMB, that's gonna depend on how astrophysics may turn out. And in principle, that can be done to some extent independent of astrophysics because YP is, there's a relationship between YP and N effective during BBN, and so you could just measure everything just at the time of CMB, but then you expect some relation between YP and other cosmological parameters, including an effective just during BBN. And so I mean, these two would be the same and effective, but if they're not, then I mean, that would be a way of testing it independent of any astrophysical constraints, right?
Yeah, that's right. So there is a measurement that comes from CMB, specifically the contribution of YP to the damping tail allows a constraint of YP. And you might say at first, oh, that's measurement of YP at a different time, but you really don't expect it to evolve between.
Right.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. So that really is a measurement of the primordial helium abundance if you can measure it through CMB. If you want to think very futuristic, you could imagine measuring recombination lines from helium, which would give another direct constraint on YP. That's probably very futuristic, but that's another possibility that uses CMB, but uses CMB spectral distortions to measure YP. So that's absolutely right. There is a constraint that comes from CMB. So mode counting for a cosmic variance limited experiment. Well, I shouldn't quite say that because there's information in the damping tail. Mm-hmm. So with polarization, you can probably go to even higher L than what people usually consider and get a better measurement of IP. So it's unclear what the absolute limit is from CMB.
Cool. So there's no other question for Joe. So we're having lunch right now. And Joe is going to be around until 3:30, I believe.
Yeah.
Thank you.